Tonight we're going to be in Zechariah chapter 6, and my plan in looking this over is to actually go through the whole chapter. The whole chapter is divided into two parts. It's going to be quite evident once you look at this. We actually have the last of these visions that Zechariah sees, and then we have a coronation of Joshua in the last half of this. And so we're going to be looking at these. Our goal is to, like I said, to get through both of these tonight. So if you have your Bibles and they're open to Zechariah chapter 6, we'll go through and we'll read verses 1 through 10, and then we'll kind of go back through this. You're going to see for the most part that this is pretty straightforward. It's not that complicated. There are a couple of interpretive questions in this passage, most of all. So verse 1, "Now he lifted up my eyes again." That's, remember, is one of the signals that this is another one of the visions. "And looked, and behold, there were four chariots were coming forth from between two mountains." The mountains were bronze mountains. "With the first chariot, there were red horses, the second chariot, black horses, the third chariot, white horses, and the fourth chariot, strong, dappled horses. And then I spoke and said to the angel who was speaking with me, 'What are these, my Lord?' And the angel answered and said to me, 'These are the four spirits of heaven, going forth after standing before the Lord of all the earth, with one of which the black horses are going forth to the north country, and the white ones going forth after them, while the dappled ones go forth to the south country. And when the strong ones went out, they were eager to go to patrol the earth. And he said, 'Go patrol the earth,' and so they patrolled the earth. And then he cried out to me and spoke to me, saying, 'See, those who are going to the land of the north have appeased my wrath in the land of the north.' The word of the Lord also came to me, saying, 'Take an offering from the exiles, from Heldai, Tobijah, Jediah, and you go the same day and enter the house of Josiah, the son of Zephaniah, where they have arrived from Babylon.'" That's actually, and I jumped into that. We wanted to stop at verse 8. I messed that up. My Bible, the section divisions, breaks it at between verses 10 and 11, and we actually wanted to break at verse 8. First of all, it's pretty plain. You see this, he sees a vision of these chariots with these multicolored horses. And he sees the four chariots in verse 1 going out between two mountains. The mountains are bronze mountains. Now, you can just mark this down if you're interested. Bronze, Revelation, just a couple of verses out of Revelation. Revelation 1:15 and 2:18 both refer to Jesus having feet of burnished bronze. And he uses those feet to step on or crush in judgment. And so normally when you see something that's made of bronze, you're looking at something that is strong and sturdy, and it's designed to execute or mete out judgment. Well, these are two mountains. And of the interpretive issues in here, this is one of the big ones. What are the two mountains? Charles Feinberg, who was a teacher at Dallas Seminary for many years in the Old Testament, ended up going to Talbot. And I read Feinberg's fine commentary on Zechariah. Actually, it's probably about the first time in a long time I've actually read a commentary from front to back and going over a book, but it was very helpful in going through this. Having said that, Feinberg's view, I don't think, is what the view is. It's possible. I see it, but I'm not for sure if that's what it is. He looks at the two mountains, because not everybody's sure what it is, that one of the mountains is, he takes them as literal mountains, seen figuratively as bronze mountains. The Mount of Olives, which is east, and Jerusalem, Zion, as the other mountain, with the Valley of Jehoshaphat between them. Because the Valley of Jehoshaphat is where God has, and we've seen the Valley of Jehoshaphat previously in the Minor Prophets. That is one of the valleys where God has entered into judgment with the nations. So he brings them into judgment in that valley. Because that's what Jehoshaphat is. Jehovah, Shaphat, judges. Okay? So it's the valley of Jehovah's judgment. So that's one possibility, according to Feinberg. One of the other commentaries I went through, he's wondering, are these the two large pillars that Solomon erected in front of the temple? Because remember, they had those two huge pillars that both had a name. And off the top of my head, I can't remember what the names of the two pillars were, but one was this and one was that. He thinks that that's that because it's indicative or representative of the wisdom, and I can't remember what the other one is with regard to Solomon, and that those two pillars represent the completion of the temple, which Zechariah isn't as concerned with the completion of the temple as Haggai was. There's another possibility. This is the one my Hebrew professor taught when we went through there, and that is that the two mountains refer to two distinct kingdoms. God's kingdom and Satan's cosmos kingdom. And that what you're looking at with these two mountains and these chariots going out between these is a conflict between these two mountains. And from a human perspective, God's mountain is seen, or shoot, the other way, Satan's, from a human perspective now, Satan's kingdom is looked at as formidable as God's kingdom is. And so there's this conflict that's going on, and these chariots are going out to deal with the conflict. I'm going to tell you that when I've gone through this, I wasn't able to draw a conclusion. Feinberg, he tells you Olivet, Zion. But he says that's what he thinks. But he says it's hard to press it. The one that thinks there, I don't have any other notes because these were my notes from class when Dave went through this with us. I couldn't tell you any more about what he said at the time. We're still learning to take good notes in class, you know. It was feast or famine in those days. You learn taking notes to learn to be selective and write good notes and not write everything down, but not to write one word down too. So, and I was still struggling with that. The other man that looks at these is the pieces in front of the tabernacle or the temple. I almost completely brushed that one aside. Whatever this is, mountains, I do believe, because mountain is used in scripture of governments. I mean, sometimes it's a literal mountain, but it's also used as centers of government. I do believe that somewhere or another, we do understand that's what he's talking about. And when he's talking about bronze, he's talking about governments that are significant and solid. Having said all that, without any really good conclusion, and you're going, okay, well, Tim gave us three views and hasn't told us what he thinks because he doesn't know. Probably, I think, the best understanding of this is if you put it together with the rest of this, that it says it's coming forth from between the two mountains. So it's as though both of these mountains are involved in the sending of this. And so in some way, you're looking at two forms of government in which these are going out. Now, are these chariots going out at the time of Zerubbabel? Don't think so. I think that these chariots are going out in the future. Because it tells us, if you would look down in verse 8, then he cried out to me, spoke to me, saying, see, those who are going to the land of the north have appeased my wrath, my fury, in the land of the north. Now, the reason he talks about the land of the north, if you remember, when Babylon attacks Israel, they do not come straight east across the desert. You would have to pack an unbelievable amount of water to move an army across a desert like that. And so they followed the Euphrates, Tigris rivers. They followed up around the north, up around the Fertile Crescent, and they came down through Nineveh and Haran and Carchemish was up north, but they came down through those and then dropped into the land of Israel from the north. So whenever they came to Israel, they came from the north, even though they were to the east, and actually a little bit to the south, east and just a hair south of where Israel lies. But they come from the north. Assyria was from the north, had come from the north. So all these enemies that came from the north, even if you were to go to the book of Daniel and you're going to look at the Greeks, when the Greeks come down against Israel from the north. Now Rome, I'm going to have to beg ignorance on Rome, but I believe Rome actually used not just foot soldiers on ground, but I believe that they brought soldiers in on the seacoast and transported men. So they came from the west more so than the north. The point of that is that all of their enemies always come from the north. And that's the way. They've got one enemy from the south, and that's Egypt. But Egypt hasn't, since times way to the past, Egypt has never been a significant enemy to the people of Israel. They've been a thorn in their side. They've been a problem, but they have not been a significant enemy like Assyria and Babylon. And even the Persians, the Medes and the Persians, as well as the Greeks. And so when you're looking out into the future, and if you take your Bibles and flip over to the book of Revelation for just a minute. Revelation, and turn to chapter 16. Chapter 16, and we have in chapter 16 we have these seven bowls of God's wrath that is poured out, that are poured out on the earth. And in connection with these, in the midst of these, if you look down to verse 12, the sixth of these bowls, it says, "And the sixth," referring to the angel, "poured out his bowl upon the great river, the Euphrates, its water was dried up, that the way might be prepared for the kings from the east." And those kings from the east are going to come together and they're going to enter into a battle, which we have looked at in other prophets. They're going to come from the east to wage a battle. That battle is going to be waged north, interestingly enough, of Israel. Okay? So we have the battle of the Valley of Jehoshaphat, which is between Zion, Jerusalem, and the Mount of Olives. But there's a battle to the north, which is the valley that's situated with reference to the Mountain of Megiddo. The Mountain of Megiddo in the Hebrew, y'all, everybody is going to say this now. The boys are. Oh yeah, Joseph's over there. He could say this with us. Everybody say Har. Okay, there you are. Y'all know a Hebrew word. That's the word mountain. Okay, so the word Megiddo, and you have the word mountain with it, you call it Har Megiddo, which if you don't put the rough breathing mark in there, or the rough breathing sound when you bring it, because there's not an H in Greek. So when you bring that from the Hebrew, which has a H, and you bring it over into Greek, that doesn't. You only can indicate that with breathing marks, and they didn't have breathing marks in New Testament times. We believe they did, kind of, you learned words, just like kids today. They pretty soon, when you're reading in English, kids learn when you say a C, like as in cat, and C as in receive, okay? And after, you just figure it out. You know, you don't have to look for any special marks anymore. You know what they are. Same thing in Greek, okay? But when they came across, you have this Har Megiddo becomes, for many, Armageddon, or Armageddon. That's how they get this final battle. And that battle takes place up to the north of the people of Israel, or of Jerusalem, up to the north and off just a little bit to the west, okay, of where Jerusalem is at. That's where this battle, and that's where these nations, these armies come from. And if you turn back here in the book of Revelation, back to chapter 6. Not 6. We're going back too far. I'm sorry. No. Back to chapter 8. Revelation 8. I'm looking at my thing and I'm seeing 6 here. I'm going, no, that's not the right one. Revelation chapter 8. Now, the sixth bowl that was poured out was to drying up the river Euphrates so that the armies can cross. This is one of the good places to demonstrate that the seal, or that the, not seals, but the trumpets and the bowls are contemporaneous. There's a lot of people that teach seals, trumpets, bowls. When we went through Revelation, we saw seals, first half, and then trumpets and bowls in the last half. And you can prove that some of the bowl or trumpets precede bowls, and some of the bowls precede trumpets. So they have to be going on simultaneously. Now, what we saw in Revelation chapter 16 was we saw the Euphrates dried up. If you look in verse 13 of Revelation 8, it says the sixth angel. Remember, that was the sixth angel pouring out his bowl. This is the sixth angel sounded, and I heard a voice from the four horns of the golden altar, which is before God, one saying to the sixth angel who had the trumpet, release the four angels who are bound at the great river Euphrates. Eight, 13. You know why? I've got a 6 marked in my margin. And my
18 is not the right chapter.
Oh, a 9. Oh, I didn't even see the 9 down here in the corner. It's tucked down in the corner where my Bible's pulled together. I saw 8 up there. I'm sorry. I'm getting Alzheimer's at 48. I'm telling you, I am so scatterbrained sometimes. I really apologize. Anyway. So we'll start over. Verse 13. The sixth angel sounded. And we're 9:13, right? And I heard a voice from the four horns of the golden altar, which is before God, one saying to the sixth angel who had the trumpet, release the four angels who are bound at the great river Euphrates. And the four angels who had been prepared for the hour and day, month and year were released so that they might kill a third of mankind. By the way, just to pause on that. God's prepared this, and they're going to go out and kill a third of mankind. This is one of those things that makes you really think about your theology and what you think and know about God. I was given a paper by a friend on missional churches. And you wouldn't believe people in seminaries that I'm hearing talking about, we're missional, we're missional. And they do not understand the background of missional. Missional comes out of neo-orthodoxy. It comes out of postmodernism, and it's one of the expressions of the emergent church and the missional idea. Well, see, it sounds good, because are we missions-minded in terms of sending missionaries and stuff? Yeah, but that is not what these churches mean when they say missional these days. In fact, this man actually defines in the opening sections of this paper that missional goes back to, it redefines our whole view of God. What is God? God is ultimately a missional God. Bet you never. Do you ever learn that when you ever study theology? That God is a missional God. He's defined as a God that is ascending God. And he says from the beginning of time to the present, God is always sending. That's one of the primary things that characterizes God, that he's always sending. Anyway, because God is, what God's goal is in sending, and he then says God's goal is to reclaim and fix, this is your mission now, for you to go out and on behalf of the kingdom of God, reclaim and fix this good creation of God. So missional theology, contrary to these groups that are claiming this, that are using this and applying it themselves, this is not just about missions. This is about fixing society. This is about fixing the environment. This is all these things. And the issue with that, when you look at things like that, God's going to kill a third of mankind on the face of the earth. One third of all humanity on the face of the earth at that time, he's going to kill. That sounds like God's ascending God, isn't it? See, they have such a narrow, myopic, distorted picture of what God really is, because they've got a rubric that they've created. They've got this framework through which they have thought out of God out here that is not informed by the scriptures. It does not allow the scriptures to be the final authority. So we go on from there. Sorry for that little excursus there. Verse 16. And the number of the armies of the horsemen was 200 million. And I heard the number of them. And this is how I saw in the vision the horses and those that sat on them. And he goes through and he's going to give the description of these horses and how they're going to make war and how there's going to be a this great amount of death that's going to transpire from this. But it's because that these are the armies, he's releasing these, and he's going to bring these armies down. And we saw in Revelation 16 that these armies come from what direction? The north. So as these armies come out, we have this great, we have these armies now coming here, and they're coming from the north. And in the context where we're looking at it, Zechariah, God sends these chariots are going out, and they're going to appease or satisfy God's wrath in the north. Okay, yes.
In verse 18, it says the third of mankind was killed by these three plagues. Is that referring back to verse 15 where it says, so that he might kill a third of mankind? Is that the means by which he kills the...
Oh, well, if you actually go back in the context, there are... if you go back to, let's see, I think you have to go to, let's see. Okay, yeah. So there's three things. It goes back, I just had to make sure I was getting my perspective on this. If you go back to verse 8 without... teaching all of this again. Verse 8 says, this is chapter 8, verse 8. It helps to be in the right place. It says, and the second angel sounded. There was like a great mountain burning with fire was thrown into the sea, and a third of the sea became blood, and a third of the creatures which were in the sea and had life died, and a third of the ships were destroyed. Then verse 10, and the third angel sounded, and a great star from heaven burning like a torch, and it fell on a third of the rivers and on the springs of water. That's fresh water now. And the name of the star is called Wormwood, and a third of the waters became wormwood, and many of the men died from the waters because they were made bitter. So we have a ruining of the waters. And then we have in verse 12, it says, and a fourth angel sounded, and a third of the sun, and a third of the moon, and a third of the stars were smitten. So we have a darkness. That darkness doesn't cause death. It just makes life miserable because you're going up in this dim light. Everything's shortened. Things are speeding up. But you had the waters corrupted in those two plagues up there in verses 8 through 10. Then in chapter 9 in verse 1, you have the abyss that is opened. You have these creatures that are like locusts in verse 3 that come out and they sting people. So everybody that has the mark on them, these people are, they don't have the seal of God on their foreheads, excuse me. They can get stung by these locust creatures. And when these locusts sting these people, it causes them such intense torment that it says in verse 5, and they were not permitted to kill anyone. So nobody dies from these locusts. But it's permitted to torment for 5 months, and their torment was like the torment of a scorpion when it stings a man. And in those days, men will seek death and will not find it, and they will lust to die, and death flees from them. I don't know what it's like to be stung by a scorpion. I've never been stung by one. I hope I don't. I've never even seen them around here. I've seen them in kids' bug collections that their kids around here have caught them. But Peg's seen them years ago, but I have never seen one around here. I think it's a little bit too wet. Have to be down where, Ed, you see them down at your place once in a while?
Yeah, we do, but they don't look like what you'd see like in a book from like Arizona or something. They're funnier, smaller, and a little different.
Yeah. One of my professor's wives, when they were living, I believe, in Texas, brought the laundry in. And when they were first down there, they didn't realize that when you hang your clothes out, you have to shake your clothes out because bugs get up inside them. And she had a scorpion that climbed up inside a sleeve of a shirt. And when she took the shirt out of her closet and put it on, it bit her on her arm. And they said for a week, stung her. For a week, she said she felt like she had a fireball racing up and down her arm. And shoot down and shoot back up. And it was just burning. That's what happens. But they don't kill anybody. See, this is important. So people are killed by, it says there's three plagues here they're killed by. And what are the three plagues? It's by the ruining of the waters. And by the armies that come out. And those are the three plagues that cause people to die. They're not killed by the day becoming a third less sun smitten by a, a third of the sun, third of the moon, third of the stars, and they're not killed by the scorpions because it says they can't die. They want to die. They hurt so bad they want to die that they can't. Death eludes them. Okay. Now, the reason we're coming over here, if you go back over to Zechariah now, I'm just trying to help you understand a little bit of what's going on here in Zechariah chapter 6. We may not get to the second half of this tonight. I don't know. We'll see. But these chariots are going out. I believe these chariots are going out, I would say, towards the end of Daniel's 70th week, or towards the end of what we popularly call the tribulation, or actually the Great Tribulation. We're in Zechariah 6. And they're going out. They're under the dictate and direction of God when they go out. There's four colors that are indicated with these. It says that the first in verse 2 is red, then there's black, verse 3 there's white, and there's dapple. And we also have these indicated over in the book of Revelation. Keeping your finger in Zechariah, you don't have to if you don't want, but I'm going to go back to Revelation 6 because we have four horses of the same color. Some people are going to say you can't make anything of the colors. Well, I would find it interesting if God indicated four horses of different colors of chariots at one point in connection with a similar event, and he does it another point in history, I would say these are of significance. They happen at different times in history, because the ones that we're looking at in Zechariah seem to be involved in what happens towards the end of Daniel's 70th week, where in Revelation 6, this is towards the beginning. But what you have over here in Revelation 6 and verse 1, it says, "And I saw when the Lamb broke one of the seven seals, and I heard one of the four living creatures saying, as with a voice of thunder, come, and I will look, and behold, there was a white horse." Now, in the Old Testament, in Zechariah, we have chariots and we have horses with them. Horses, not just a horse. Here, these are four single horses. So draw the distinction. In other words, what you have pictured in Zechariah is you have whole armies. So you have an army of white horses, army of red, army so on and so forth. Over here, we have single horses with single riders. They're each indicating a condition or state. So the first one, it says, the white horse on here in verse 2, "I looked and behold, there was a white horse, and he who sat on it had a bow, and a crown was given to him, and he went out conquering and to conquer." And with a bow in your hand, what are you doing? You're conquering by warfare. Okay. Verse 3, "And when he broke the second, I heard the second living creature saying, come, and another red horse went out, and to him who sat on it was granted to take peace from the earth, that men should slay one another, and a great sword was given to him." So it's actually the removal of peace. The red is looking at it's just at warfare, the lack of peace. We'll keep going. Verse 5, and just to remind you of something in here a little bit, I need to remember to remind you of this. Don't forget it. Verse 5, "And when he broke the third seal, I heard third living creature saying, come, and I looked, and behold, there was a black horse, and he who sat on it had a pair of scales in his hands, and I heard, as it were, a voice in the center of the four living creatures saying, a quart of wheat for a denarius." Denarius, remember, was a day's wages. Okay. "Three quarts of barley for a denarius, and do not harm the oil and the wine." So you can stop and think about that. What he's telling you is, a quart of wheat is what you're going to grind up that's enough to make bread for a day. So in other words, a day's wages, a denarius, for one loaf of bread. Could you imagine whole day's wages just to have one loaf of bread, or have one amount of bread for a day? Or barley, because barley was cheaper. You could stretch further. That was your... Verse 7, "And he broke a fourth seal, and I heard the voice of the fourth living creature saying, come, and I looked, and behold, an ashen horse that is kind of gray or dappled, and he who sat on it had the name Death, and Hades was following him, and authority was given to him over the fourth of the earth to kill with a sword, with famine, with pestilence, and by means of wild beasts of the earth." So there's a number of things that are used for people to die. None of these are individuals. And this is important. We'll just remind you of this. The first one on the white horse, that's not the man of lawlessness. Okay? Doesn't say it is. All these are conditions. And the first one is a condition of people going out, maybe an individual. But it's not saying this is just an individual doing it. but the condition of warfare for the purpose of conquering. The second one is a condition of warfare and a lack of peace. The third one is famine as a result. And the fourth is pestilence and death. So there are four conditions. Okay? You got a question?
Okay. The person being, whatever, sitting on a horse is not given?
No, none of these are, in other words, he's not saying that's the man of lawlessness. Because if, let's put it that way. If the man of lawlessness, if in verse...
I'm not saying it's the man of lawlessness, but like verse 7 and 4, and another red went out to him who sat on it, it was granted to take peace.
Okay, but if that's the case though, then you go down to verse 8, and it says, and I looked, and behold, there was an ashen horse, and he who sat on it had the name Death and Hades, which means there is some individual, and his name is Death and Hades. See? In other words, all of these are talking about a condition. So what he's doing is he's seeing four states pictured by four individuals riding four distinct horses. But he's looking at states or conditions. Okay?
Peace, that's what's
sitting on the horse. Yeah, lack of peace taken from the earth. Yes. So, now, if you go back then to Zechariah chapter 6, when you have these four horses over here, I do believe that since we can go from the... keep in mind, when the Old Testament writers wrote this, and this is one of the things that modern evangelical scholars don't always appreciate this, but and we've tried to point this out, I don't think all these Old Testament prophets always understood what they were writing. We know Daniel didn't. Daniel asked some questions about some of what he was writing. And God told him, it's not for you. Close up the book. We know Peter tells us that. We know that they said they were looking, searching, trying to figure out how does this all go together? As they were prophesying generally concerning the grace that is to us. Generally, they were prophesying about it because they saw Christ suffering, dying, and then resurrected, and they couldn't figure out how that worked together. And as they saw that, that's what Peter is saying. That's generally grace concerning us, is the death and resurrection. We're looking this side of the death and resurrection of Christ. And that is one of the reasons that you and I get to have grace. So as they're looking at, I'm just saying this because I don't know that when Zechariah is prophesying this, or anybody's reading it, that they fully understood what all of this referred to. What they can't understand is what's stated, as we said in verse 8. When these have gone out, God's wrath is appeased. Now, with these, if we can kind of remember a little bit of what we had in Revelation. It says, with the first horse, there were red horses, plural. So we have an army. Verse 2, the second, there was a black horse. Remember what the black horse was over in...
red horses.
Red horse was taken peace, so it's a state of warfare. Okay. The black horse was a state of, wasn't the black, I gotta see, now I'm gonna have to go over and look. But the black horse is the scale, so it's a state of famine. Okay. The state of famine. And then three, the white horse, that's a state of conquering. Going out to conquer. And then there's the dappled one, and the dappled one is a state of death. So now let's go on and look at these. And he says, then I spoke and I said to the angel, what are these, my Lord? And the angel answered and said to me, these are the four spirits from heaven going forth after standing. I went through this word today, went back through this. I didn't do this when I was studying this originally, but I went back and looked at this word standing today. It's a word that always has the idea of standing ready for something or standing to watch or be on guard. As an example, Miriam was stationed by her parents to stand watch over her brother Moses when he was in the basket floating in the reeds. She was stationed there to see what would happen. Okay? And so there are a number of examples of that. I wrote down some others if you're interested. Moses stood before Pharaoh to speak on behalf. So it's an official. So you're either standing waiting for something to happen, to watch. You're ready. You're not just standing around. It's always the idea of standing with a job or waiting for the job to come. And so Miriam stands to watch Moses. Moses stands before Pharaoh to speak to Pharaoh about on Jehovah's behalf. The angel of Jehovah stood as the angel before Balaam and the Balaam and the donkey. Okay. And Goliath stood in challenge to the armies of Israel. And it's real easy. If you just go through and look at these, you're going to find out that this particular word stand always had the idea of to stand on the ready, to stand ready for action, or stand to see what was going to take place. Okay? There's another really common word for standing in the Old Testament, and this is not it. This is a distinct word. In fact, when I was going back reading the Hebrew this morning, reviewing this, I was going, well, I got to look at that word again, because I must have done work on it. I had it translated, but I didn't remember the word because it's not a common, it's not the common Hebrew word for standing. Okay. It had a different connotation. The idea then being in verse 5 is that these are the four spirits of heaven going forth after standing before the Lord of all the earth. And frequently, and this is important for you to understand, we have this expression that's translated in many of our English Bibles, like over and over, it's in Zechariah here quite a bit, Jehovah of hosts. You read that? Or the Lord of hosts, Jehovah of hosts. And that word host, if they translated it accurately, the word means armies. I don't know why they translated host. I think it's the effect of the old King James. But the idea is, he's the Lord of armies. He's Jehovah of armies. And so he's up there in heaven, and he has these armies that have been standing ready to march at his command, and now they're being sent forth. And he says in verse 6, with one of which the black horses are going forth to the north, and the white goes forth after them. So they're going to meet these armies of the north, and they take with them, if black is comparable to the black in Revelation, I don't have any other reason to believe it's not, it means the state of famine that exists as a result of this, the pestilence that exists because of this. And along with it is this conquering. In other words, when these armies are in the north, ultimately, there's going to be a conquering of the armies. Those armies aren't going to conquer. God's going to conquer them. In fact, the book of Revelation chapter 19 says that Jesus, when he comes out of heaven, he goes forth and the armies of heaven attend him when he goes to fight the battles. And he actually fights several battles, because before he ever shows up to fight the battle of Armageddon, he actually has been down in Bozrah, which is down in Edom, and it says, why are the bottoms of your garments splattered with red as though you've been treading the winepress? And he says, this is the blood of men. He's been stomping men like a person stomps in a grape vat, and the bottom of his garments are splattered with their blood. That's a battle he's fought before he ever comes up into this direction, before he ever comes up towards Jerusalem and then up to this valley. Then it goes on in verse 6, and it says, and the dappled ones go forth to the south country. Dappled, if you remember from Revelation chapter 6, was a state of death in Hades, exactly. And so they're going down there. Does that mean there's no death in the north? I don't think that that's the case. He's just really showing you where these are going out to. So you've got some going north, some going south. And it says, and when the strong ones went out. Now, what are the strong ones? Well, what color have we not yet seen?
Red.
We haven't seen the red.
Set up verse 3. The strong dappled horses.
Yeah, the strong dappled horses. I've got to take a quick look at this, though, just to answer your question here in verse 7. This and then, yeah, there we go. In other words, most people think that when you come down, what you have is at the end of verse 6, you have the dappled ones going to the south. And then verse 7, and when the strong ones now. So he's looking at something different than the other horses. Or than these other three. So in other words, this is what most of the commentators do when they come to this. They say, well, this is the red ones, because the red ones have not yet been accounted for. They haven't done anything. And the red ones are the most fierce. And so he uses this term, the strong ones went out. And they were eager then to patrol the earth. In other words, when the red ones go out, they don't just go to the south or go to the north. They go out into the earth. In other words, they cover more than just the north or the south. Because they're warfare. So they're going out and they're waging war all over the place.
So the strong ones are the red ones.
That's the way I understand it when I went through here. Because you don't have the red ones accounted for in the context. I don't know. Because this is the thing, I don't think verse 7 is referring to the dappled horses, because you have the dappled horses in verse 6, and then to verse 7, you then talk about this other group that seemed to be distinct from the dappled horses. And when the strong ones go out, which he's already sent out the dappled horses, so it seems like you have two distinct groups of horses there. That's my understanding. Don't have a better answer for you. I wish I did. So they go out to patrol, and then verse 8, and he says, and he cried out to me and spoke to me, saying, see, those who are going to the land of the north have appeased my wrath in the land of the north. Now, land of the north is the place primarily where God's wrath is mostly going to be appeased, because that's where the hugest battle is going to take, or the largest battle is going to take place during Daniel's 70th week. And I believe that that is what this is referring to. And it's looking at a time. And we've kind of been seeing this as we've been going through these visions, that these visions both have things for Joshua and Zerubbabel at the present time. This one, less so. This one's looking more off to the future, when God's saying, listen, all these nations, whether they're coming from the north or whether to the south, I have armies that I'm going to send out against them. And I have things that I'm going to do. And he's going to send those armies out, and especially to the north, he's going to appease his wrath. Okay, he's going to send it up there, and literally that idea of to appease, he's going to cause it to go up to the north. And they say appease is the way they translate that here in my Bible. And how do they mark this in the margin? Literally, cause my spirit to rest. In other words, they're going to deal with God's wrath by his spirit actually having rest with regard to this. The spirit, if you stop and think about it, the spirit, if you go back to Genesis chapter 6, God says over there, my spirit will not always strive or wrestle, or it's actually the word deen, to act as judge or one that contends with mankind. Because I'm going to number mankind's days. There's going to be a short time, and I'm going to do away with them, which means the Spirit's not going to have to continue to do that. Is the Spirit contending at the present time? Yeah, according to Paul, he's contending in 2 Thessalonians 2. He's withholding the man of lawlessness, so Satan can't bring the man of lawlessness out. The mystery of lawlessness in 2 Thessalonians 2 is that Satan has always had a man ready to bring on the scene. But the Spirit withholds him so that he can't just do it at will. He can only do it when God lets him do it, when the Spirit ceases restraining. So the Spirit has carried on this work in time. He has carried on a work of contending and striving and being upset. In fact, actually, your opening verses of the book of Genesis, you see this. It tells us, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And then it says in verse 2, and the earth was formless and void, tohu wabohu, that is in a state of judgment and chaos. That is not primal creation. No matter what our very, and we are all creationists. We are seven day creationists. But we also believe that there is a gap. And it's not a gap to account for billions of years of geologic evolution. Because how is geologic evolution substantiated from an evolutionary point of view? By the presence of fossils in the rock layers. Fossils indicate what? Life. Was there any kind of biological life on the planet before the 7 days that we read about in Genesis 1? No. So you cannot have or account for geologic ages in that gap. And yet that gap If you let most creationists today know that you believe in any kind of a gap between Genesis 1 and Genesis 1-2, you are branded almost a heretic. They almost think you're as bad as Darwin himself. They really can't stand it because they think you're completely giving in. Okay? But I believe there's a gap there. And one of the things that happens, it says, and the Spirit was moving. And that word to move there is a word to brood over or to hover or to flutter over. It's the idea of one of the places it's used of what a hen does when she's all upset and she's moving over her chicks all uptight. Why is the Spirit doing that? Because the Spirit, according to Ezekiel, had been anointing Lucifer. Lucifer sins. And the place where Lucifer had been reigning or ruling from is judged by a universal flood. And it shows you then how the Spirit responds. So Spirit has this, shall we say, this wrath, this anger. And it's expressed, and I believe that that's what Zechariah is looking at here, is God's Spirit taking rest with regard to this in the north. Because of what these angels do. These armies go out and they take care of this. Spirit doesn't go out and take care of it. So what's interesting? You're getting reminded. You think, well, the Spirit's the one that's angry. Why doesn't he the one that go out and take care of this? He doesn't do it. Who's the one that actually appeases wrath on the planet of the earth? The Son. He's the one that comes and wages war. Okay. Not the Spirit. Okay. Foolishly, I thought we would get through more. We're already at 46 minutes. There is no way we can even begin to do justice with last part of the chapter. Does anybody have any questions or comments here to add at the end? Let me look over my notes if I missed anything. Does anybody else have anything? Oh, and so, by... Okay, go ahead.
So there's a universal flood. Okay, so God judged the earth because of Lucifer's sin by flooding. Is it the whole earth or just the...
It flooded the whole earth. Okay. Yeah. Said that.
It's interesting. Okay, so he did that again with Noah's time, and then he said he's not going to do it ever again.
You actually have two statement of two floods. Turn to 2 Peter in chapter 3. Mm-hmm. 2 Peter chapter 3, you actually have a statement about this, and there's a Mennonite interpreter by the name of D. Edmund Hebert in his commentary on 2 Peter. He actually is one of the few people I've come across that in a regular commentary thing that actually points this out. But it says in verse 5, and he's talking about, let's go back here and look at, let's pick up the context. Verse 1, this now, beloved, is my second letter I'm writing to you. In them I am trying to arouse your sincere intention by reminding you that you should remember the words spoken in the past by the holy prophets and the commandment of the Lord and Savior spoken through your apostles. First of all, you must understand this, that in the last days or latter days, scoffers will come scoffing or mocking and indulging their own lusts and saying, where then is the promise of his coming or his presence? From which time the fathers fell asleep, everything is continued from the beginning of creation. In other words, since God created, there's never been any change. What you see today is the way it's always been. He says, for it escapes their attention, literally is the word here, their attention, this, and they desire it to be. So he actually uses a participial form of the word desire. They want it to escape their attention. They don't want to see it. That the heavens existed from old, and the earth, now so he says the heavens, nothing ever happened with the heavens, but the earth, he says, out of water and through water. He actually uses two words. The out of water in the Greek is the word ek, and through water is dia, because there were two things that happened. If you go back to the initial creation that you have, when God floods this, the earth is formed, and it says, remember, what does God say about the land back in Genesis 1 creation day? What's his language? Let the dry land appear. So you've got a flooded state. Nobody denies that, even if they don't believe in a gap. Everybody agrees the earth's originally in a flooded state. They may just think God created it that way. Okay. But then God says, let the dry land appear. Now, how's he going to do that? Well, he's going to cause the waters to be gathered into one place and the land into another. Remember, when God initially created, all the land was in one location. It was all one thing. Although, again, modern creationists do not like the idea of continental drift. And you know why they don't like it? Because the secular scientists believe in continental drift. But the secular scientists think that continental drift has been taking place over millions and millions of years, and it's always been a couple centimeters a year like that, and yet Genesis tells us that the continents separated in one man's lifetime of about 300 years. So in 300 years it separated. It could have separated in 50 years within his lifetime. It doesn't tell us that it took the whole 300 to separate. Okay, and his daddy named him Peleg probably because it was starting to happen at that time. And it completed its separation during his lifetime. But daddy calls him Peleg. It meant separate by water. Okay, yeah, there's several places where you can find that word in forms of it. And it always means to separate or to divide by water. Okay, and it tells you that over there. It actually says in Genesis over there, it says his name was Peleg, for in his days, the earth, the physical ground, was Peleged. Uses a verb form of the word in there. Okay, and I have a commentary upstairs by a man that's a young earth creationist. I'm a young earth creationist. I could be an old earth creationist. I actually know how old the earth is. I have no way of telling. They say, well, geologic evidence. Hey, you're being, when they do that, they're being just like the evolutionists. I have no way of gauging the earth's age because I can only base its age off of scientific evidence based on what's happened since God started doing this. I can't go back any further than that. I have no way before God disrupted this in judgment. I have no way of doing it. And they won't accept that. They don't accept that. They don't want to do anything that even in their opinion gets close to evolution anyway. I'm not here to pick a fight with those guys. They really are brothers. But they've just become unreasonable in the way they look at this. But it's all in one place, and they don't want that. They don't even want this. But he says, let it appear. Now, what happened? So here's the land. Okay, so we have the earth like this. God brings a flood over all of this initially, and this is Noah. So this is Genesis 1, and this is Genesis 7 and 8. And God brings the flood on the land then, and then what does he say? He brings it through. He causes the water to dry off from the land. It's different than what he did here. And so he says, very plainly here in this verse, that it escapes their attention that the heavens, they desire it to be so, that the heavens then were from long of old, and the earth out of water, and then standing together through water by a word of God. So, and both of those, and what are both of those? If you get the understand the point, these are mockers. What are they mocking? Nothing's ever changed. Now, why are they really saying that nothing's ever changed? Just because they're just uniformitarians? Is that the only reason they're really saying it? They've got another objective. What's their objective?
They say nothing's going to happen in the future. They just live all however they want. There's going to be no judgment.
There it is. That's the word. No judgment. Because what is this? We know the flood of Noah was what? It was judgment. What was this flood? It was a judgment. They don't want ever to acknowledge that there's ever been any judgment. If they can say no judgment in the past, exactly what you were saying. No judgment in the future. And there's two of those. But there's actually even more than that, because the splitting of the continents was a judgment. It's a judgment on what happened at Babel. See? But Peter doesn't even get into that. He just deals with the two floods here. Okay. So yeah. So there were these two floods. Boy, talk about a question that was off our main topic for the night. But that's okay. That's okay. Hey, I brought it up. You got to take whatever questions you bring. Anybody else have any? Did Ann answer that sufficiently then? Okay. Okay. Anybody else have any questions? And I'm sorry I couldn't do better on answering your question about the red horses and the strong ones. And it is, I had to go back and look at it to remind myself, it is the same Hebrew word. It's Amets. So.
So, Tim, when you were talking about the Holy Spirit hovering, all upset, after the first flood, with Lucifer, the fall, and all that, is he doing doing that because he's wanting to protect the earth? That's all about.
You know, I'm just going to have to say I don't know for sure exactly why he's doing that. I think it seems to indicate. I think it seems to indicate something that there is. He's expressing, I think, on the part of a person of the Godhead, a state of grief over a condition that exists there. That's hard for us to understand because we have this almighty eternal God that we, in some ways we don't think he has sensitivities like we do, and yet he expresses that. Tells us in Genesis 6, it says, and God was grieved over what man did. And we take it and we say, well, that's describing God in human terms. So we call it, instead of an anthropomorphism, we say an anthropopathism, a pathism, a suffering, a feeling. Fancy word we use for it. But the thing is, I don't have a problem, I think, understanding that maybe in some way God is bigger than the way I can understand this. We want to make God so powerful that we make him sometimes so aloof that nothing down here affects him. And I think God is telling us in those things, there is a certain way in which it doesn't change or alter him eternally. It doesn't change the fact that he is always happy and always good. But that doesn't mean that when people sin that God's going, oh, goody, 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 goody. I mean, I think they have to have an understanding balance of the way. It's very plain when you go through the Old Testament that God doesn't appreciate the way these people act. And so even though it's for us kind of a mind bender to wrap our mind around that in terms of theology proper, doctrine of God, I think we just need to understand that there are ways that God relates to these things that the best way God could communicate it to us is in terms of what we do. So if I experience grief over something horrible that happens, is that totally exactly the way God has it? Probably not. But in my mind, the way I understand grief, God's saying this is probably the best way you're going to understand the way I related to this. Because I think with the magnificence of God, I think the way that God relates to those things, because we don't understand that. How can you be happy and grieved all at the same time? Probably about the closest you as a believer get to something like that on earth is when you have a dear beloved believer who has been racked with pain from a disease. And God takes them home. You are happy for them immensely. And yet you are grieved because they're not with you. Because there's a part of you that's still a little selfish. And you don't want them suffering, but you still wish they were here. Because you miss their presence. If God were to choose to take my wife, I know I would be deeply, deeply grieved. I would be really happy for her. But I can guarantee you, much of a crybaby as I am, I'd shed a lot of tears. And I would be really broken up. And she could tell me all she wants, buck up and be okay, hon. It's fine. Just remember where I'm at. But you know, when you say stuff like that, you know that's not the way people are going to react. Because they do miss you. Paul doesn't say you don't have grief. He says you don't have hopeless grief. God knows. So, in other words, if you stop and think about that, I think that's probably about the closest we can get, that you have this mixture in there. But I still even think that's inadequate to really express it, because I don't know that God experiences grief exactly like we do. Anyway, I'm kind of rambling a little bit at this time, but I'm just really trying to impress upon you that when he's expressing these things and what God is doing here, it's to the best of the ability, giving us word pictures to kind of describe the way God relates to these things. In a level that, like I said, I'm just trying to think of examples. When I talk to theology proper, especially when you teach about God's decree, there are certain things that are real mind benders for people, such as the fact that God says he doesn't change. In one place, God says, I'm not like a man that I should change my mind. And yet, you know what? We actually have a Hebrew word that's used many times of God that says, and God relented, God relented, God relented. And the word relent is a word, we translate relent, but it's a word meaning to alter your thinking from this direction to this direction. Kind of a little bit like our word repent. It's almost as though God had a change of mind. How does God say that? How, on one hand, does God say he doesn't change his mind, but on the other hand, he does? Well, the theological answer is, well, God always intended to do this. But he acted as though he's going to do this, like Jesus with the two disciples on the road to Emmaus. Acts like he's going to go on until they beg him to come with him, and then he goes on with them. Maybe that's the case. And you're going to spend a lot of, you're going to have a lot of theologians and a lot of philosophers within Christendom that are going to spend a lot of time and spill a lot of ink trying to answer that question. And quite frankly, I don't know that down here we're ever going to answer it. I don't know that it's, let's put it this way. I don't know that it's our job. I don't know it's our job to always figure out exactly how God acts in all those things. God says, this is the way I did it. And we go, that doesn't sound like you over here though. Yeah, well, that just shows you, you really got God figured out, don't you? God tells you where you can depend on him. He tells you how you can depend on him. And he tells you, shows you a lot of things about his character. But you know, there's a lot of aspects of his character. You're going to spend all eternity going to, every day is going to be a new and exciting thing. Unlike school when you were a kid, where there were days you're going, oh, more addition, more subtraction, another story to read, whatever it might be. It's not going to be like that in heaven. Every day is going to be a new lesson about God. Every day, that's fun. Okay. Anything else? Now we're at an hour. We have to stop. No. Seriously, does anybody have anything else? Nobody else wants to get me started.